everyone, welcome back to another episode of Trail Culture, Season 2, Episode 3. I'm your host, Em Robertson, and I'm so stoked that you're tuning in. I hope you've been enjoying the start to Season 2. We are back from the Otter Trail, where we covered the backstory and history of what happens there every year. It was really a special time, and that stretch of coastline really does remain a magical space. As you all know, Season 2 kicked off with the exciting news that Trail Culture is fueled by Carbon Endurance for Season 2. I am really stoked about this partnership. There is an amazing team doing some incredible work in the trail running space when it comes to nutrition and how to fuel correctly for whatever challenge you have laid out for yourself. If it's an FKT, if it's a race, if it's just some intense training blocks that you're going through, Carbon Endurance really has a little bit of something for everyone. The details are in the show notes for you guys to check them out, and I really just appreciate their support. I hope you all enjoy episode 3 of season 2. Tune in next week for our next one. Okay, hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Trail Culture. This is season 2, very exciting. We've had a couple of episodes that have been recorded for this season, and we are doing things slightly differently. And this week we are chatting to a professional in the sports space, Hilton Lazar. Many of you will know him, and for those of you who don't, I'm stoked about what he has to share. Hilton is a Cairo, a dad, a husband, an outdoor adventurer, and a professional for sure. I've heard rumors as well that he has a wicked sense of humor, and I'm just stoked to have Hilton on the podcast to talk about chiropractic, what it is, what it entails, how does a chiro fit into the professional team that surrounds athletes, and would a chiro recommend running, and more. So it's great to have you on the podcast, Hilton. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
So alongside with outdoor adventurer, Hilton is a dad of 2, 3, and 8 months, and he's here today to chat to us. He's somehow smiling and is hopefully getting some sleep. Probably not enough.
No, I have to credit the amazing childcare to my wife. I think she's kind of the one that's kept us on the straight and narrow. So
nice.
I think the thanks needs to go to her.
Epic. The teamwork. I love it.
Absolutely.
Hilton, to start off, it's always nice just to have a bit of background on the human that we're chatting to. So tell us a little bit about yourself. How do you find yourself in the sports space, but also what made you decide to become a chiro?
I think I've always had like a fascination with the sciences, the environment, and then I think that kind of evolved as I was moving into like the later years of school, and I kind of had my mind set on summing in the health sciences. And we had a family friend who was a chiro, and I went and shadowed him, and I was kind of like, I could do this, like, yeah, this is something that I would want to do. And I applied for a couple of other fields of study, and I got accepted to chiro, and I kind of started from there, and it's been, yeah, that's how it's kind of evolved. And chiro as a study, especially in South Africa, is an interesting one, because I'd say for like the first 2, almost 3 years, you're not really doing much hands-on work. We do like a really intensive course in anatomy.
Yeah,
I'd say it's probably the closest thing to actually doing an undergraduate degree in gross anatomy that you can get. Like, we spent a lot of time like in a dissection hall.
Wow.
And so it's kind of one of those things where you start the degree, but you still kind of don't really know what you're in for until you get to third year. I mean, there are like classes in philosophy and that kind of thing. And yeah, then once I started like with the clinical stuff, I really started to enjoy it and kind of get into it. And I suppose where I am now, as opposed to when I graduated, it's, some people might look at it and not even assume it to be chiropractic. I mean, I think obviously at the heart of it is adjustment, like the adjustment is what would differentiate a chiropractor from another body worker.
Is that like a physio?
I suppose physio, massage.
Okay, okay. So adjustment is what?
Manual therapist, Got you. I think that's the differentiating fact, is that the adjustment is the hallmark of a chiropractic treatment. Like, that's what I think most people expect to get when they're coming for an appointment.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, so I graduated at the University of Johannesburg, and then I had a practice in Johannesburg for a little under 2 years. And then I got a wonderful opportunity to work in Eaton Road with Dr. Rob Beffer. Yeah, and I kind of learned my craft there with Mike Watson in the back. He's a strength and conditioning coach, and Derek Rao and Murray Ingram and Phil and Lynn Burnham. And that was kind of, yeah, that was the my kind of like where I really learned how to hone my craft. And our offices, the offices there, I think by way of geography, like by way of location, was we were smack bang in the middle of the city bowl and had a following already in the sporting community. I know like our practice worked a lot with Red Bull. So when I started there, I had amazing exposure to like a lot of extreme sport.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just running. It was like big wave surfing. It was king of the air, BMX, skateboarding, then trail running, Ironman.
So cool.
So like coming from Johannesburg, that kind of stuff is completely novel. I mean, like the only thing you surf in Joburg is the internet. And it's not like it's not like you're ever going to see a surfer walk into your offices. And yeah. And I think having that exposure was priceless. And it was like, I think when you work with people who are practicing extreme sports, there's two sides. The one is the injury side, but there's also like a performance component.
So cool.
And I think having that as like a, like in my formative years of practice and kind of being able to work and like make mistakes and like be curious, and then meet people along the way, like, you know, James and Meg and Bianca and kind of all the, like the people that have, yeah, that I've worked with over the years. It's been, it's kind of, that's been how, like how I've formalized my work and my understanding of what I do.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I think as far as my, I suppose chiropractic, depending on how you understand it, or by definition, I'll explain the underlying philosophy is that we all have this innate intelligence, and this intelligence, the vehicle for which the intelligence moves through our bodies, through our brain, our spinal cord, and then the peripheral nerves, and that rotations in your spine, which we call subluxations, block the flow of that innate intelligence. And chiropractors, by way of manipulation, move bones back into place, and yes, the innate then kind of restores itself and flows. And it's the idea that the body's like self-organizing. It organizes, yeah, itself around this innate intelligence, and that if it flows, like, you'll be healthy.
Yes.
And then the things that drive the subluxation is the three T's, which are thoughts, trauma, and toxins. And, you know, I think what I try and do is appreciate that chiropractic, for me personally, is a metaphysical practice. It's not wholly a physical practice.
Yeah.
It's physical in that the act of the treatment is physical, but the premise behind it is not necessarily something you can measure in a lab or in science, yeah, or, you know, so like, I think when you start to understand chiropractic as a profession, there's two distinct styles. There's the very vitalistic style or pure style, which, yeah, is very much subluxation based. And then there's the blended style where you kind of look at it maybe from a more physical perspective. The underlying basis is maybe like more physiology. So like somebody would walk into the office and go, I've got pain in X place, and the rationale behind it is not necessarily metaphysical, it's more physical. Like, what is your physiology doing and how does the work that I do change that, kind of change your physiology? And I think, I don't think either is right or wrong. Our profession is somewhat divided in terms of like two camps. One camp believes in the metaphysical premise, one camp believes in the physical premise. And so that's chiropractic basically in a nutshell. And I think both have their place depending on what you want.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think also there's an underlying like kind of, there's got to be a buy-in from also the person receiving the treatment. And so, like I said, there's a divide and the one camp says, well, actually, you know, like, you're kind of like diluting the philosophy, the science and the art by doing all this additional stuff. And the other camp says, well, you're providing a metaphysical solution to sometimes a physical problem.
Mm.
So in some ways, like, it's kind of can become confusing because then when you need to create standards for care, like how do you create those? Like, you can go to 10 different practitioners and you can have 10 wholly different experiences. Mm. And so, you know, when you start to think about like, I suppose more mainstream medicine, because there's no real standard for essentially care, how do they get on board and support it? And, you know, that's been the biggest, I suppose, the difficulties. A lot of it's also in the languaging. Like, technically a subluxation is like a partial dislocation. Like, if I write on a notepad, like, hey, he's got subluxation at L5-S1 and I send it to a medical doctor's going to look at you and go like, what do you mean you've got a subluxation in your hip joint or your knee joint? You know, that's like, that requires like specialist intervention.
Yeah.
And so I think in some ways the way chiropractic is seen by the medical profession at large is unrecognized in its potential, and it's unrecognized because of the way it's understood.
Mm.
I think that's changing. I think in South Africa we have a really good standard of education. I think as a bare like basics, when you leave university, you're pretty well versed. And I think that's also because at the training clinics, we're required to be primary contact physicians, which means if you walked into my office and you had a diabetic foot versus like a sciatica, which was referring to your foot, I need to be able to know the difference and then refer you to the appropriate person.
Mm.
So the training is encompassing of being able to look at somebody and say, hey, this is within my scope, this is with very not important. Within my scope.
Yes.
And so I think that's really important because then, you know, we kind of garner trust with the public. And
And you're working in the best interest of your patient. So you're staying within like what you're comfortable with within your scope of practice and then referring out to a different kind of medical practitioner based on the scenario that walks through the door.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then in South Africa, the training is such that we do get trained in the auxiliary therapeutics. So I would go as far as saying as South African chiros are probably some of the best dry needlers in the world. We started in fourth year, we start dry needling.
Sure. So, yeah.
I mean, I've been dry needling now probably 14 years.
Mm, it's a lot of experience.
It's a lot of time with like, and I think that's quite novel to our education where there's a lot of that like hands-on, there's auxiliary stuff. So it's massage and I suppose like soft tissue work and the dry needling and then the machine stuff. There is that, I don't know that the equipment is like shockwave and high-powered laser.
Yeah.
But we're trained in those modalities, so we know what they do and we know their place and we know how to use them if you choose to do so.
Mm. But there's an element of what I'm hearing is like almost like building your craft. But like you've got multiple options of instruments or techniques, and then it kind of comes down to, I suppose, you as an individual and also the types of patients that you're seeing for kind of what you would maybe want to specialize in. Is that so? You've got tools in the toolbox and then... But what you use the most kind of differs as like from one individual to the other?
Yeah. I really think it also boils down to philosophically what you believe in. Like, some people strongly believe in this, the power of innate. And, you know, I do too. I love that there's a metaphysical premise, because we're more than just the sum of our parts and what we see and feel and our physicality. And I think, but it doesn't always answer people's physical complaints or problems.
Mm.
And that's always been the part for me where the other stuff helps. And then I can only speak from my experience, but my master's really kind of changed the way I think and feel about what I do. Essentially, my master's was, we had a really fancy gate plate at our university that nobody was using, and I went for a research meeting and they're like, hey Hilton, you're going to do the research on the force plate in the podiatry lab. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do the research then, it's cool, like I've got something that can give me some objective measures, and the stats will be easier to kind of work with. And when I took it, I was kind of like, okay, this is cool. But then the subject matter was basically connecting how a neck manipulation affects your gait.
Mm.
And so the study design wasn't particularly good, but it was basically 60 people. They had to do a walk on the plate. They got a manipulation of their neck, and then they had to walk on the plate again.
Okay.
And irrespective of like the study outcomes, what I got out of it was that I essentially had to connect the dots between somatosensory input, so like how the mechanics of the neck and the integration of head, neck, eyes, ears, all affect how you understand where your center of mass moves in relation to your feet, which is running.
Yes.
And at the time, I was unaware of that, but what it did was I had to connect a lot of dots. So a lot of the connections between why I was doing what I was doing and why it worked were hypotheticals.
Mm.
And so I came across a lot of kind of authors and researchers that have really kind of shaped the way I think about how I work. And then kind of from there, that's when like my interest in chiropractic and or physical medicine grew. And I think that was kind of where my curiosity started, in that, hey, this is like, there's an endless road here.
Yeah.
It's like, however you decide to interpret what you do,
mm.
there's always more than enough like insight to be able to take that and make it usable and obviously make it into a philosophy that can serve people, you know? Mm. And I think that's kind of how I've gotten to where I am. But it was always, that was one of the kind of the critical points in my like career, where like my research really shaped how and what I think about. And even now, like a lot of it is still like, I think back to that kind of premise.
Mm.
And yeah, that's kind of my story and how I feel about Cairo. But yeah, it's contentious. I mean, there's a lot to be said for. Unfortunately, I think our profession is somewhat divided, and I don't know if it needs to be, but I'll leave it at that.
And I think one of the things that I wanted to ask you was to talk about like myths in the industry. So we've had a couple of like healthcare professionals on the podcast, from like strength and conditioning to sports physicians, you know, to physiotherapists. And in your kind of context and through the lens like that you're looking through, I wanted to ask, like, what are some of the biggest myths that you come across when dealing with people who have maybe never been to a chiropractor before, or things that you find yourself constantly kind of correcting within your industry?
Directly related to chiro, like, if you adjust my neck, will you break my neck? Like in the movies, like, are you like some kind of ninja that can like snap my neck?
Yeah. And your jiu-jitsu background, they probably, definitely. Doesn't help. Yeah.
So the answer is no.
Hilton will not break your neck. You can be a recurring patient if you go to him. Yeah.
I always say to people, like, if a car accident doesn't break your neck, like, how am I supposed to generate the same? I mean, if you think about a rugby player in a collision, it's like, I think what I've heard is it's like basically being hit by a bus.
Yeah.
Or it's like sustaining like a car crash with a truck. So like, if that's not breaking your neck, like, my hand cannot create the same level of force.
Yes.
And I think most people, you know, will tend to kind of like resist you. They won't like allow the joint to kind of be moved through what we call the elastic barrier of resistance, where like the joint capsules being kind of opened up. So that's part one. Like, I don't believe I'm strong enough to like snap somebody's neck. You might sprain their neck at most.
Mm. But even though that's not the intention, you're not going in here being like, I'm just going to see if I can pull this joint as hard as I can in one direction and hope for the best. Yeah. That's not it.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think it lends itself to the fact that if you believe that, then like, you kind of like, in some ways have an underlying thought that you're that fragile. Like, I don't think people are that fragile. So,
yeah.
And I think the second one, as a more global myth, is like the, oh, my glutes firing. I get that a lot. I mean, if you can get up out of a chair, your glutes firing, or are my glutes weak?
Mm.
And then depending on how you understand weakness.
Okay, like, the terminology comes back into play here. Yeah,
I think it's language that like is the problem. And I think a lot of people then tend to get fear-mongered, and like, they've got this label now that like, my glute is weak or my glute is not firing, and how do I get it to fire? And I mean, it's firing if you're using an exercise band. It's firing if you're getting in and out of a car. It's firing if you're getting up and off a chair. It's like, it's firing if you're walking. It's kind of one of those things where to kind of unravel that and get people's heads around the fact that like, the terminology is wrong. And there's a whole bunch of like physiology going on, especially when body parts are sore. You know, like the brain's pretty efficient at giving us a call to action when things are going wrong. And I think I don't think it's helpful kind of giving these catch terms that put people in a position where they're like, how do I fix a glute that's not firing?
You know, so interesting. Hilton, so one of the things you said now was like putting people in a box or giving a label. I'm sure you experienced this, especially with perhaps patients who've been referred, but I want to point to the athletic population now. So dealing with athletes who come in with an injury, but they've been like labeled with this injury, and then perhaps you see them and you go, that's maybe not the first thing I would have said. So for example, I went through something last year where I had what I thought was ITB that I was really struggling with. And by the time I'd like done the rounds and I'd been told so many things, and I'd just been like forced into this box of this injury, and which to a runner is like, oh, this is like a devastating one. And then eventually I went to see actually a biokineticist, and he went, that's maybe where you started, but he's like, you're just reaffirming this word or this injury now. He said, you're actually way past that. Let's reassess, have a fresh look. And he actually never diagnosed me, if I can say that. He never labeled it. He was just like, there's a couple of things we need to look at, work on. I got some exercise prescription, and then it was amazing for me, the upward like trajectory for recovery from there, as opposed to just going around from like one doctor or like from one physician to the other who just kept putting a label. So like, thoughts on that, working with kind of athletes or patients who come in with that mindset?
I think it really depends on the person, you know, and again, I think it's like really important part of everything is really listening to the person. And I think getting a gauge of where you meet that person, right? Like, some people just need a label. Some people, they need to know what's wrong. Some people need a scan.
Yes.
Like, they just, like, they need, like, something physical or tangible like to go, okay, like, power. I've got this. Now I can create a plan and I can move forward with things. And some people, some people don't do well with that. Some people feel like, okay, this is, you know, the truth is when you give certain people a label, it can very easily become a catastrophe. They catastrophize it and it's like, now I've got this thing. Now I don't know what to do with it. And then it's a jump on Google and it's like, you know, the worst possible case scenario. And so I think, you know, I try and kind of paint a picture of like, the truth is that you're more than just a person in reduction. Like, there's some pretty good research out there where they've kind of done imaging and they've looked at people and they found pathology on MRI or X-ray. I know the knee's a pretty big one that they've studied. And if they surveyed 50 individuals, like 48 of the 50 would have some level of pathology on the X-ray or the MRI. But it's incidental. They didn't know that it was even there. And they're walking around, they're running, they're cycling, they're doing their thing. And so oftentimes it lends itself to that thing of like, how important for certain people is structure and label? And like, my whole thing is like, if you can provide people with a good movement experience, a positive experience with movement, it kind of doesn't really matter whether they've got ITB or not. Like, if they can move on that leg and they can go, oh, hey, like that feels good, automatically, like you can get load bearing into the joint, you can get load bearing into the tendon or the tissue, whatever's not happy. And from there, the brain starts to, like, your brain's an experience machine. It adjusts expectations in terms of how it understands what's happening there. And then it goes, well, you know, I've bent my knee 10 times under load, wasn't so sore. Maybe I can reduce some of the threat. And by reducing some of the threat, I can reduce some of the pain output. And then you've all of a sudden got somebody who's gone from a place of hobbling to walking. And then you go and say, okay, cool. Like, let's give you some exercise work to do. And the modalities help, like, you know, the hands-on work helps. It helps desensitize things. And then I think giving people some agency in terms of like, I can go home and do
X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. X, Y, and Z. And stress test. Like, you know, like actually going and saying, hey, like, you know, you've got what I think is either mild, moderate, or severe. If it's mild or moderate, in 3 or 4 days, I want you to go and run for 20 minutes. Make a mental note of if or when it starts to hurt. And that's your threshold. Like, from there, like, for most people who are running, they want to run, whether it's 15 minutes or 50 minutes. If you're injured and you can still get out the door and get some fresh air and some sunshine, and even if it's 15 or 20 minutes, they'll take that.
Yes.
Instead of being told, well, stop 4 weeks.
Moving with immediate effect.
You're not doing anything.
Yeah.
And I do think there's a place for it. You know, when things are moderate to severe, then it's like, okay, cool. Like, you know, maybe we need some downtime here and like, deloading or non-weight bearing. For most of the things that I see, I would say like it's in the minority where I advocate for complete rest. You know, if there's red flags, if there's a stress fracture or there's a grade 2, grade 3 kind of sprain, strain, or broken bone, then you got to do your due diligence. But I mean, I think for the most part, I think I read a really interesting article, must have been about 2 years ago, about this guy Rob Krah, who's a maniac. I mean, he's a 100-miler. He's like, he's an old dog. And I think it was at Leadville. He ran down like quite a shale, like a steep shale embankment, and his knee literally like exploded. And they took him to the medical tent and they were like, dude, your knee's a mess, you need a knee replacement and blah blah blah. But one of the things I took out of that is like, a knee like that doesn't just get there, like in the moment. It's not like it was there and then it wasn't there and then he ran down the hill and then it was there. That had been there probably for like years.
Yeah.
And he had run relatively pain-free for years until it had obviously
had enough.
The hill had enough and it had triggered something there. But I think that's the point that I always try and make, is that we're more robust than what we're led to believe. And sometimes when you give people labels, unfortunately, it takes away a lot of their agency. And I think there's a lot to be said for who you give a label to and who you don't, and who it's right for and who you don't. And I think there's a lot to be said also for like having good screenings and like allaying fear, like going like, hey, this is like, you're not going to need to see the orthopod on Monday. Like this is within the conservative realm. You don't like, you don't need an MRI. Yeah, you don't need an X-ray.
The extreme measures here.
Yeah. You need to move on it first, and we need to stress test it and see like, what can this tolerate before we start like, you know, going and,
you need surgery or you need extreme intervention. Yeah.
And I think, you know, the interesting thing is a lot of people arrive and they're like, they're panicking. They're like, am I going to need an operation on my back or my knee or my hip or my whatever?
Yeah.
And sometimes just hearing that like, hey, like,
maybe, no, probably not. Yeah.
No, I don't think so. It's like, oh, wow, that actually feels so much better.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot to be said, yeah, for listening to people, meeting them where they are. And then having an understanding of what's in your scope and what isn't. And then like a feel, there's like, that's where the experience part comes in. And like having seen lots of things that are severe, moderate and mild, and then going, as far as my pattern recognition is concerned, I think this is like milder. And then, you know, giving it a trial of care and saying, well, if it's not better in X amount of time, then let's go and have a look and have a scan or this or that. But like, to jump to aggressive like intervention straight up, I'm not convinced that it makes people any better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think what I'm hearing as well is you dealing with a lot of kind of athletes or patients, but who are in a lot of pain. So do you feel like pain, or is your experience of people with pain, like, does that affect how they view their injury or their situation? What you said now was like, you feel like people come and they panic. Do you think, like that the pain is often a cause of like, I've just been in so much pain, I'm grasping at straws and maybe I should just go for the surgery. You know, what is your kind of experience with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends. It depends on the nature of the pain, whether it's like a chronic thing, whether it's an acute thing. Like most people who are in acute pain, like they walk in and they're convinced they're dying.
Yeah.
It's like they walk in and like the hunched over back, or it's like I've pulled something and they're really hobbling. And then, and those people oftentimes they're convinced that there's something badly wrong with them. And then you're like, actually, it seems bad. And I think that's also where like the understanding of physiology helps, is because, you know, there's two parts to, I suppose, the pain conundrum. Is like there's a peripherally mediated part and a centrally mediated part. And I don't know how much of it is like centrally mediated or peripherally mediated, but I think like to make it easier to understand, the central part is your brain and how it understands the context for the pain and then what it outputs. And the peripheral part is like, I've had an injury, there's an inflammatory response. It's creating sensitivity in the nerve endings within the area. Within the periphery, there's pain generators, but then centrally, there are things that can generate pain. And the way I kind of think about it is like, you know, if we're going to use a joint issue, for example, like your joint has lots of little nerve endings and those work like WhatsApp. They have the potential when exposed to, let's call it an inflammatory response, to WhatsApp your brain. And they're kind of saying to your brain, like, hey, listen, man, like something here is sensitive. Your brain doesn't necessarily have a gauge for it, the severity. It doesn't go, oh, this is a grade 2 lateral collateral ligament sprain. It goes, my knee on the outside of the knee is problematic, and how would I make myself aware of it? And the awareness or the call to action comes in pain, stiffness, tightness. Those are all kind of on a spectrum. And they're interchangeable. So sometimes you see people like they're sore and then they get stiff and then they get tight, or stiffness and tightness interchangeable. But the point is that a lot of these things are perceptions. It's like your brain is generating pain to go, hey, you've hurt your knee. Like, and you know, I think about, there was a chapter in one of David Epstein's books. I think the book was about this idea of like, is like physical prowess and performance innately Is it like innate or is it earned? You know, is it like your genetics or is it through hard work? And it had, the chapter had a lot to do with that. But like what I took from it is it was, I don't remember the exact details, but there was a lady who was missing a part or missing function in a part of her brain that was pain recepting and pain producing. And I think she went on to become like one of the best ultra endurance runners ever, like better than the guys. And I'm talking like 200-300 mile races. Mm. And it was also because she would have like boils and blisters on her feet and her joints would be destroyed from running 200 or 300 miles.
Yeah.
But she didn't feel it. So it didn't, there was no cause for her to stop. There was no like
threshold stopping her.
There was no call to action there to say like, hey, you're doing damage. And it got to a point where like she eventually just faded into obscurity because like her physical body stopped working. Her joints wore out.
Couldn't sustain.
She couldn't have like, she had like no muscle tone because her nerves were completely shot. Like,
wow.
And so there was a good lesson in that like what it said was that like, you know, I think pain is a multifactorial experience and there's a lot of things that can change how you understand it and it is very protective. And so it's like that's part of the kind of the understanding is that like it's here for a reason. It doesn't feel good in the moment, but it is serving you.
Yeah.
And I think like
interesting, but we don't want to stop you. Like this pain is hindering me from achieving X, Y, and Z. And you're like, maybe just to suspend that right now to deal with this.
Well, I don't necessarily think about suspending it. I think about understanding it differently and kind of like if it's a protective mechanism to allay safety, it's like it's keeping you safe.
Yeah.
How do you create safety in the system without like kind of like, I suppose, like making it feel unsafe? And movement is a good way to do that. An adjustment is a good way to do that. I would say dry needling is part of that, like some hands-on work. Like, you know, a great anecdote that my anatomy professor like kind of shared with us in second year was in embryology, when you develop from three clumps of cells, endoderm, mesoderm, ectoderm, and your skin, your brain, and your nervous system all develop from the same clump of cells, right? And so your skin is the biggest essentially outward extension of your nervous system. And he said that's where the cliche, like that the power of touch comes from. It's because like when you're handling skin or you're handling the fascia or you're handling the stuff underneath it, in some ways you're influencing the nervous system. And if the intent through the input is good, if it feels good, the brain internalizes it and then it goes, okay, this is a good feeling around an area that feels threatened. I can kind of allay some of that
safety.
I can allay some of that. And I mean, this is, I suppose, relatively pain science-ish. And that's how I think a lot of the modalities work. They're less mechanical.
Yeah.
As opposed to
your massage guns, your massage therapy, things like that. If you've got patients saying, you know, this is what makes me feel better, what helps, then you're going like, great. If that's creating a, like a safe or like a good sensation for you, that it kind of aids the rehab process.
Yeah. And I mean, I think like I used to have a bit more of like a firmer rule on those things about how I thought about them. But like ultimately, you know, like I think about comrades runners, right? Like my understanding is like, I don't like hard massage. Like to me, it doesn't feel good. I don't feel good afterwards. Like my understanding of like fascia is it's a delicate organ. Like why would you want to smash it and rub it and bruise it and blah, blah, blah. But a comrades runner, if a massage is not sore, it doesn't work. Why? It's because like the expectation of what is going to make me feel good
is not,
if it's not being met, if it's not hurting, then it's not working.
Yeah.
And it's the same for like, you know, like camphor or wintergreen. Like people ask me like, do these transect patches work? And I'm like, you know, what I would say to you is they probably work because you associate the smell of the patch with like, I don't know, like in my childhood, like I would get like something minty rubbed on me if I had a something that was painful. And I was like, oh, that smells like healing.
And wow, so like, that's so interesting.
You know, the patch, you smell the patch and you're like, ooh, that's minty, that's cooling, that changes the sensation on my skin, dilutes some of the pain signaling, but it's, your brain is an experience machine. And if you provide it with an experience that is safe, then it's probably going to kind of downregulate some of that pain experience. And I think that's where I see like the modalities having a big role.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're going to go back to some of the myth related stuff, it's like, it's that thing of also like this idea that like a lot of the, I suppose, passive stuff that people do, like static stretching, changes the length of tissue. It just doesn't do that. Like if you were to take a towel and pull on a towel for a minute, it doesn't change length.
Yeah.
And I think if you stretch for long enough, like if you stretch for an hour a day for like 10 years, then yeah, you'll probably change the physical capacity and characteristics of like say your hamstring. But over 30 seconds, you're harnessing like the stretch reflex. It's a reflex.
Yeah,
you're triggering it. It gives you a sense of like a change in range of motion or a change in perception. Like stiffness and or tightness changes when you stimulate that reflex.
Yes.
And it's neurologically regulated. It's not it's not necessarily structural.
Yeah.
And so if you have tools that can change the way the nervous system is expressing tone, tension and pain, you can change the way people feel pretty quickly.
This is so interesting for me, Hilton. Yeah, this like the role of like your neural system and like how the brain's role in like movement and injury and like the dysfunctional, like if it's like patterns almost, like I think stronger than we think. Or that's what I'm getting from this.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think when you layer, and like we were alluding to earlier when we were talking about like that whole like stress piece, like once you layer the autonomic nervous system into all of that, you know, like the picture that I paint for people is like if you were to be rating how you feel on a day where you were lying by a pool with like a cocktail versus like a day where you've got deadlines and you're at the office and you've been sitting and you've had a board meeting and a whatever, like the way your autonomic nervous system internalizes that and kind of the way it plays itself out in your body creates a completely different picture for how you would feel. And I think that's the thing, is like pain drives a sympathetic response, and like with an extended period of time, I personally don't think this thing of like people are like always talking about the sympathetic nervous system and how like the sympathetic nervous system is bad and you always want to be parasympathetic and blah, blah, blah. But if you never accessed your sympathetic nervous system, you wouldn't be able to get out of bed. You would have no real motivation or drive. And so that's the first thing I always talk about, is like sympathetic nervous system isn't a bad place to be.
Yeah.
But for extended bouts of time, it's not a good place to be. And I suppose the consequences on your bodily systems that come with being there for too long, and pain is a driver of a sympathetic response. It's like a vicious circle, like pain drives sympathetic response drives pain because it increases your interoception. So your internal awareness of how you feel and it like sharpens it. So like what you would feel on an ordinary day is like a 2 out of 10. When that sympathetic nervous system gets ramped up, all of a sudden becomes 6, 7, 8, 10. And so then you've got a recipe where like you're trying to manage your autonomic piece, which is, you know, where all the mindfulness, the breathing, the meditation, whatever your pick, a good walk in nature.
Yeah.
And then managing like, I suppose, input and output. So I think a big part of like the work we do is education and like explaining these things to people in terms that they can understand. And then I listened to a great talk a while back by this guy psychologist. His name's Paul Conti. I think he's an expert in the field of trauma.
Mm.
And he said the two things that constitute good mental health, and I believe they constitute good health in general, is like, the one is really cheesy, it's gratitude, but the second one is agency.
Mm.
And I think as gatekeepers of people's health, when they come to see a practitioner, like oftentimes the relationship is like doctor-patient, like superior, inferior, or, you know, and like the gatekeeper of like...
Mm.
And so you got to, for me personally...
People are coming to you for a reason, yeah.
Yeah, like my responsibility is, how do I create agency for people?
Yeah, that's like, great.
You know, like, is bringing them back 1,000 times creating agency for them? Are they too reliant on me to manage themselves? And that's something it's like, for me, always like the ongoing development, where it's like, how do I create more agency with the tools that I have, the knowledge that I have, and kind of, you know, how do I create... It sounds strange because it's not a good business model to have less reliance on me.
Yeah, there's like this tension where you're like, you need to come to learn to... And then once like the agency is installed, then I want to not see you.
Yeah.
And that's not a personal... That's not like, oh, I don't want to see you as a patient, but that's like, it would be great if I... saw you running on the mountain as opposed to coming into my office.
Yeah. So I think, that's kind of like from my side, like the goal is like always like, how do I create agency for people? And I think it starts with just allaying fear. Like, no, you know, even another myth is like this thing of discs and disc bulging. It's like, your disc is like the ligament in your ankle, right? Disc injuries exist on a spectrum from like a mild disc strain to a full extrusion.
Mm.
It's the same as like an ankle sprain. You get a grade 1 ankle sprain and you get a grade 3.
Mm.
And yes, they obviously differ in severity. But on both accounts, they don't necessarily require like serious intervention.
Mm.
And I think there's like, that's the thing, is like there are a lot of like, you know, kind of buzzwords around like, oh, they come in and it's like, I got a slip disc. And I'm like, I'm not so sure about a slip disc.
Yeah.
Yes, you have a disc problem. Yeah. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's like, you're now going to have to go for an MRI or an injection or a procedure. So
interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a lot about just understanding and like kind of changing some of the culture around... labeling and medicine and
language that gets you
used. Yeah.
I'm learning so much. Like, as we sit here, I'm just like, wow, this is so cool. And I mean, segueing into this topic, like I called kind of one of the things we want to talk about, like health and trail running. And I think playing like, or continuing on the myths, like a question that I get asked a lot, and I want to know, like, from your perspective and in your expertise, what you think is like, is running good for me? You know, so in this example, I mean, we can talk about running, trail running, but as a chiropractor, everything you've, like, what you've studied, your way of viewing things, like, what would your response be to that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, the first question would be, and it's kind of like the path that I'm starting to go down in terms of how I'm thinking, is like, when I suppose when I see a patient and like I see something is like not working, I always say, well, fundamentally, are things working, right?
Yeah.
And if I am to say that fundamentally, the fundamentals for maybe not, but like walking would be the fundamental part of running. First, you would walk, then you would probably run.
Yeah.
So if walking is good for you, like why wouldn't running be good for you? And I think where it becomes problematic is when you're not prepared for the load that you're about to kind of expose yourself to. So, you know, the answer to the question is no, there's no right or wrong, good or bad. It's like, I say yes, because I think running, I think it's intrinsic to humans. Like, I think, you know, if you look at our we're bipedal by design, which is efficient in terms of running. We have inbuilt mechanisms which are designed for dampening of load, heavy load. So like when we're running, it's 5 to 8 times body weight landing. We've got really, really good kind of neurological mechanisms that are designed to allow us to balance and to move through complex environments. And so if we have all that stuff like built into us, like in some ways it's been predetermined that like running is a natural evolution for us, I think there are, that's why I like trail running, because I can speak personally, like when I run on certain surfaces I get sore. And I think like impact from certain surfaces may or may not be as natural as other surfaces. Like if you're going to run on like the prom, which is, and let me put it to you this way, like running on the prom is harder than running on the road because it's concrete. It's like, it's got a very different feel.
Makeup, yeah.
And I think, I think conditioning is really, or being conditioned for the load bearing that you're going to be exposed to. So I think, also like running as far as like health is concerned, I mean the benefits are numerous, like the cardiovascular benefits, I think just being outdoors, exposure to vitamin D, the mental health, and kind of a return to more of a natural order. I think as humans we kind of like we're drifting from that. And I think like being outside is the quickest, easiest way to kind of get back there, you know?
Yeah.
And if running is the vehicle,
then
by me, it's healthy. Mm. Like if that's the way you're going to access it, like that's a good place to start.
Yeah.
And then I think from there, like as long as it's kind of the approach to it is well measured, you know, like.
Yeah.
I think to exist at the extremes, it doesn't necessarily end well. Like you know, people who tend to kind of like start hard and fizzle.
Yes.
But I think like just starting with something as simple as a five couch to 5K is a good a good starting place. It kind of gives you a taste for it. But I absolutely think running is I think it's fundamental to us. Like I think there's a reason people love it. There's a reason why it's probably the most practiced, I want to say, hobby or sport in the world. It's basic. It doesn't require a lot of like thinking.
Yeah.
And I think it like it ticks all the boxes for what good health is. Like, you know, like I think about this triad of the bio, psycho and social, and biologically running does wonders. Psychologically it, for a lot of people it does wonders. And then as far as your social constructs, you're in a nice environment. So it ticks all three boxes. There again are obviously examples where it goes horribly wrong, which
again perhaps when taken to the extreme, like you mentioned.
And that's also in a professional sense, but I would always like encourage it. Like I think it's a great pastime.
Awesome. Yeah. Oh, an advocate for the sport. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
I want to read something that comes from your LinkedIn profile, which I just found this really interesting, and I really like the kind of philosophical like lens to this chat. Mm-hmm. But something you wrote, and I don't know if these are your words or someone else, but I'm starting to see the links in philosophy of chiropractic in treating causative factors and the relationship of dysfunctional movement patterns as an indicator of a deeper problem. So something I've taken from just chatting to you now is you meet like a patient when an athlete comes in and you look past the symptom to the cause, or that's like kind of where you're trying to go. And with like the dysfunctional movement patterns as an indicator of a deeper problem, and I'm going to health and trail running.
Sure.
Are there like typical kind of those functional movement patterns you see from trail runners. I know, so just to give everyone a background, Hilton works with many great athletes, a lot of top trail runners, and we're going to get into kind of a bit of more the psychology of working with those sort of individuals just now. But what are things that you're typically seeing in the trail running space that you feel could maybe be avoided, or it's just like a lack of knowledge?
I mean, I wrote that a long time ago. I was trying to sound LinkedIn smart.
you are smart. That's something I'm taking from this. This guy's a bright guy.
I think my thoughts around, like, well, dysfunctional movement patterns have changed a lot. I don't think there's dysfunction is like a loaded word, because it's all function at the end of the day. Like, again, like, body self-organizing, and it's like it's going to get you from point A to point B irrespective of your function or dysfunction, and whether you can like assess that and change that, very difficult. I don't think there are a lot of people in the world that can like that have an exceptionally good eye to like really look at somebody and go, that's dysfunctional. They might need to spend some time and pick apart individual pieces and go, oh, that doesn't work well, that doesn't, and like, and then trying to reintegrate that into like the whole is difficult. But what I would say is, so I had a lot of time to think, I suppose, over COVID. Well, I worked, but I mean, there was still quite a bit of time. And I think that's where I was really lucky with the people that I worked with, especially Mike Watson. Like he's kind of a guy who's always kind of like tinkering, and he's curious, and he's always learning, and I kind of jumped on the ride with him for some of the stuff that he was getting into. And I think what I started to realize is that, like, you can really nitpick. Like, I can examine somebody and I can spend hours and hours looking at how like their feet are moving and how their tibia is turning and blah 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 blah, but what I decided to do was take a bigger picture look, and I think for me, like, where I see a lot of things going wrong is feet, hips, lower back. And so in saying that, like, I kind of use a set of prerequisites when I'm assessing somebody. Do you have a foot that moves into its two shapes, which is a pronated shape and a supinated shape? And within that, like, what you got to remember is that the body couples movement. So when you're foot is pronating, or you're dampening load, your hip is internally rotating. When your foot is supinating, your arch is getting high and you're starting to toe off, you're moving into your toe off part of the gait phase, your hip is externally rotating. So you've got coupled movements there, right? And I think this is a difficult one for me. It's like chicken or the egg. Is it the foot first before the hip, or is it the hip before the foot? And I think that's like context dependent. Like, if you've got a patient who's has a disc issue and there's a lot of neurally regulated tension in their hip, I would say the hip is the precursor to potentially a foot. And kind of from there, you can start to work, and then you can start to like exclude labels. Like, oftentimes, like, people walk in and go, doc, I got plantar fasciitis. I'm like, when you woke up this morning and you took your first step, couple of steps out of bed, did it feel like there was a knife going into your foot? No, not really. So I'm like, the likelihood then that you have like moderate to severe plantar fasciitis is small. Yes, you may have a spur, or you might have signs of, but that doesn't necessitate the diagnosis. And then what I'm going to say to you is, can you do the basics? Does your foot flatten well? Does your heel bone move well? Does your hip internally rotate when you're flattening your foot? And so I can screen those things, and then I can say, okay, cool. Like, what I see given the screening is you have a foot that doesn't necessarily flatten well, or you're starting from a position of relative flatness. You don't get into a supinated shape. And when you start to look at how that corresponds to the movement coupling, do you really get your hip into a good position when you're driving out of your toe? Maybe not. And so therein lies like how I understand kind of starting to understand more like the movement pattern and movement dysfunction stuff. Whether it is dysfunctional or not is debatable. At one point I was kind of like looking at like I don't know if you've come across the FMS, which is a functional movement screen. And the functional movement screen is, for its time and when it came out, was revolutionary, but it is in some ways a bit too reductionist. It only looks at specific parts and then changing the pattern at that part. And it's like, the thing with also a lot of like the testing is that to be able to say on a, like on an, I'm not going to name the test or the system, but it's basically where you lie on your back, you put one leg out and you have to bridge your hips up. It's like to make an assessment of that. If you made an assessment of it in the morning, at midday, and in the afternoon, you would probably see three very different results, you know? And it's like, so how your body outputs movement is going to change relative to environment, relative to what you've done that day. It's like...
So interesting.
So in some ways, like, there are certain things that are givens. Like, your bones move into certain shapes. And if they don't assume those shapes, like, the muscle actually has to take up some of the slack. So the way I think about it is like the bone is the steering wheel. It guides the joint into its shape. And then the muscle either lengthens or shortens to decelerate or move it into its relevant shape. And those are givens. Like, bones move into shapes. And if you can get them moving into the right shapes and you can get them moving well, then you can kind of... Again, like chiropractic philosophy 101, is body will self-organize itself. And so therein lies like how I think about kind of like that piece. I mean, I hope that answers
question. No, it does. It's interesting. Hilton, have you heard of the like the concept of self-optimization? This is, I think, a biomechanical thing, but what you're talking about with like self-organizing and regulation, it sounds like that's the more like complete image. But in biomechanics, it's like your body will select the best way to get you from A to B if we're talking about walking or running mechanics.
It's like efficiency.
Based on you. So, and this is a huge thing with I've hit my head. I've learned so much in the last couple of years, but with like biomechanical analysis, can you change my running gait for me? So people come and it's like, and this is it. So one of the great myths of this is like heel foot striking is bad. Yeah, like heel striking. I'm a heel striker. That's why I've got all whatever you want a list of the symptoms. And it's like, well, that's not actually true. Or it could be not true in this case. So to take one movement pattern and say this is across the board for every individual, as you said, like a dysfunctional movement pattern. So that's just a no. And anyway, it was coined self-optimization, where loads of intervention studies where running gait was manipulated or changed. The better thing to do actually is just what you're talking about, which is not go from 0 to 100, do the appropriate amount of running for the level of conditioning that you have, and then allow your body, the 10,000 hour rule, to self-optimize. It will choose the best way for you as it learns. And that's not what most people want to hear, because that takes time. That means I can't go from my couch to being an Olympian in 6 months. And nobody wants to hear that. I digress. This is so interesting. Being a healthcare professional is one thing. Working with athletes is another thing. And now as I'm chatting to you, I'm starting to understand why your reputation precedes you. But working with elite athletes, is that different to kind of, I want to say, regular patients, regular humans? You've got people who are coming in and their goals for the year or their job is running, for example. And now they've got like an injury, or perhaps they're not injured, and you've got athletes coming to see you as almost like, I'm not going to wait for my car to break down. I'm going to take it in and service it. What is that space like for you working with people? I mean, you've mentioned big wave surfers. The other thing I assume was kite surfing. So you've got these kind of top end athletes coming in. Just chat to us a little bit about that. I'm fascinated.
So I think my experience with people who rely on their physicality for their profession, they're professionals, firstly, and I think they're putting food on their table through like their work per se. And I think expectations are very different. You know, like what I would say is that, like, and I think that's the other thing when you're working with the elites, is that at those levels, it's a tightrope. And on one side of the tightrope is performance, and the other side of the tightrope is injury and niggle. And they're always dipping their toes on either sides. There are very few who really manage that tightrope, like, really, really well.
Yeah.
And so I say the approach generally is also less is more there. Like, so you get a really good gauge for... There's almost like the Formula One analogy. They're like some of them are like Formula One cars. It's what makes them good, is they have such a distinct, unique feel for their sport and how they move and how they understand their bodies. And you do too much, you get it wrong. You do too little, you don't quite hit the mark.
Yeah.
And it's figuring out that sweet spot, and like, and sometimes it's the difference between one or too many like needles during the dry needling, or maybe too much adjustments, or, and I think that kind of work for me personally has kind of allowed me to get a sense, like when you work at the extremes, it gives you a sense of what works and what doesn't, and how to refine the dosage that you're giving. And I think as people, like most of them are like people first, and they're doing a job. I think that's the thing that people forget, is that, like, I think when you're representing a big brand and a sponsor, there's like a lot of commitment to that. It's like, it's like, in some ways, it's like me having to pay my practice rent, you know, like that's my commitment to my job.
Yeah.
And when I don't pay it, I can't work. And so for, you know, I think a lot of them, there's a lot of stuff that they're coming in with, and there's a lot of like expectation, and typical job expectation is, it's different because, like, you're in some ways also, I suppose, you're in the public, like you're in the limelight. You've got the expectations of the public, you've got the expectations of your sponsors, you've got to put food on your table. And in trail running, it's still like, in South Africa, I mean, I don't know that you can necessarily make a good living from it just in South Africa. So I think there's kind of that pressure too, you know. And I think, like, in those spaces, it's a lot of like kind of like planning, like, okay, you've got X, Y, and Z, this is what it's going to look like. And then also working with the coach. That's where I've been really lucky, because like I said to you before, I work with James and Meg. I see a lot of their athletes, and I have a close relationship where I can pick up the phone. I can say, these are my notes. This is what I saw. What do you think? And James will go, oh, this is what I think. Like, can we come to some kind of middle ground in terms of like how we move forward with this? And then if it requires like more intervention, like I can refer them, and then,
That's so great. So,
it's very collaborative, which I think definitely helps. It makes the athletes feel safe, and it gives them like a sense of like, okay, there are people that have like got my back here, you know, like I'm not just like being left to hang out to dry.
Yeah. And they're talking to each other while staying in their lane. I think, and that's something my hope for, as like something like trail running, like the professionalization of the sport happens, that I hope the healthcare providers are like secure enough in what they do to get on board with that. I find, and through different chats and also my experience of like, everyone's just operating in single lanes that never there's, you know, lane is not a good one, because you can like run alongside each other, stay in your lane and really talk and come like work as a team. But just this thing of working in isolation, it doesn't serve the athlete in the end. And then you get people who just are bounced from one person to the other, or just referred and no one ever talks. And if we could just get maybe 2 out of the 5 people in the room, or that it would just make all the difference. So that's really encouraging to hear that it works.
And I also just think like recognizing that, like people are good at running, but they're good. They're just people at the end of the day. Like, to not be like kind of caught up in the hype of like who somebody is. Like, most people are just, they want to be heard and they want some problems solved for them. And, I think most athletes are just people first. Like, I think I learned that, like, kind of, I've had the good fortune of seeing a fair amount of the Terex athletes. And there were a few senior athletes that, like, before I had worked with them, like, I had this idea of who they were and what they were. And, like, and then I kind of met them. I think Ruth Croft was one of them, who's like completely down to earth, like just a good person. She runs for a living. I'm a chiropractor for a living. You're a sports scientist for a living. Like, it's, yes, it's her passion and she loves it and she loves being outdoors and whatever, whatever. But ultimately, we're all just, I suppose, people doing our thing, you know?
And to blow it up isn't always a great idea.
And I mean, I do think, that comes with obviously life experience and stuff. So
we're all learning. This is great. I feel like I've learned so much as I'm sitting here. I'm like, the cogs in my brain are turning and it's awesome. Hilton, as we're rounding out, it sounds like, I mean, you've learned a lot. You've got loads of experience, but what is like a significant lesson that you've learned from working? And I wrote here working with trail runners, but I'm like, let's say in the elite sports space, that you feel like has carried over into your practice day to day.
Listen to the story. Because the story will always tell you, like, people know what's wrong with them. Listen to the story. Part one. And then part two is, like, I'm a firm believer in the way I see my work is dosage dependent. Too much, it overwhelms somebody. Too little, falls short. Somewhere in the middle. And then the third thing is, again, is that piece of agency, like, how do I create more agency for this person? Is it the simple act of saying, like, I don't think your Achilles is that bad. If you're seeing me on Monday, go and run around Lion's Head for 30 minutes on Wednesday. Give it a stress test and then come back and see me and let's see how we go from there. And I think those three things go a very long way for how people feel and how they understand their problem, and especially athletes, because it's like I said, their day-to-day is it's a physical existence. It's like they need their physicality to kind of make a living and do their jobs. And I think when you can kind of give them a sense that, hey, physically you're going to be fine, they respond well to that. And I think those three things are, for me, the most important. Like, and then, I think meeting people where they are, like knowing where somebody's at. And I think it's a lot about also, like, I suppose, relationship building. Like, it goes beyond just like, this is a runner in front of you. Like, who's this as a person? What else is going on in their life? And then I think that's something that, you know, I learned from my mentor, Rob, is like, it was one thing, like, he always had a good knack for knowing, like, you could sometimes say, this is purely emotional. There's like, there's something outside of like physical that's going on here, you know? And he'd always say, like, I think once this situation outside of whatever they're telling you is going on, it subsides, like
stabilizes, this will improve.
Things will change. And that, in some ways, it's quite an esoteric idea, but it definitely holds true, you know? And I think there's that part, there's the metaphysical piece outside all the physical stuff. And I think appreciating all that and goes a long way. So I think it's like kind of a balance of both physical and, I suppose, non-physical stuff and appreciating it and kind of being open to it and kind of expressing that. And then, relationships. Like, if somebody feels safe with you, I think that's a big part of the battle won.
That is amazing. Hilton, this has been so interesting. I feel, I've learned a lot. What I'm taking away is that our bodies are stronger than we think they are. They can do a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely.
And kind of this understanding what links to what. My emotions and my thoughts and things are not totally separate from the symptoms that I'm seeing physically. Like an injury is not a thing on its in isolation to just the knee or the IT band or the ankle. There's look at, like, zoom out and look at everything else. So.
Yeah, and I mean, there are things that we like haven't even gotten into, but like just honestly, just doing basics well, like sleep well, go for a walk.
Oh, the good
stuff. Hydrate yourself well. Like, I know there's a lot of stuff around in terms of like self-care and all that sort of jazz, but the ultimate self-care is like drinking enough.
Yeah.
Sleeping well.
Give yourself the gift of 8 hours of deep sleep.
Yeah. I'm moving well, like, and it's like, it's evident. Like I saw some stuff the other day that like your tendons have their own circadian rhythm. And just like your brain has a self-cleaning mechanism when you sleep, like that whole glymphatic thing and how it kind of works, all the byproducts of neuron metabolism during the day. Your tendons do the same thing during the night.
No ways.
And I mean, I don't know how good the research was, but there's mechanistic evidence to suggest that like when you don't sleep enough, like the way the tendon kind of cleans itself, like from at a cellular level, is impaired. And it's one of the big things around like tendinopathy and healing of tendons is good rest, good sleep, actually.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, that's my thing, is we can't, you kind of like, we're like integrated systems, and like when you do things that serve the system as a whole, it serves you as a whole. And I think there's a lot to be said for real, just real basics. Like we want to like meditate for 30 minutes a day, and we want to,
we had the cold plunge chat just now,
the cold plunging and like, but if you don't hydrate well and you don't sleep well, like you're kind of starting from a place without any like fundamentals. And
you're putting a plaster on an open wound. Also, something I usually ask people, I ask them like a round out question of what's their favorite trail and why or something like that. But for you, I want to ask you, what have you read or listened to recently that's inspired you? Doesn't have to have anything to do with running.
Ooh, I've been reading fiction, so I like lots of stories, but... I would say Basil van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score. Really good. Really, really, really good. And then there's a guy, Todd Hargrove, Playing with Movement. That's a really good one if you want to just understand movement better. And I subscribe to his, he's got, I think it's called Substack.
Where
he writes a lot of his written content.
So awesome.
And then the talk by Paul Conti. I can't remember, he was on somebody's podcast. I don't remember whose podcast it was, because he did most of the talking. But it was exceptional. Like it was all like, I'd say those three.
I'm gonna get those links. I'm gonna stick it in the show notes. Cool. This has been great, Hilton. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. Yeah,
I'm going to have to have you back. We didn't even get into our cold plunge and recovery modality thing, so we'll just have to have you again.
Cool. Thank you.
Thanks. There you have it, everyone. What an interesting conversation with Dr. Hilton Lazar. It's fascinating to understand what trail running does to our bodies, the role of adjustment, injury diagnosis, how to manage pain, and just the general thought of movement and how we should be thinking about and looking after our bodies. I hope you all enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you back here next week for our next one.